housekeeping matters. I want to introduce first Corning Middle School from Waukesha. Our students are present. Would you please stand so we may see you? Thank you. You may be seated. This class, as classes that will come at 10:45, are part of the Court with Class program that the court operates with the State Bar of Wisconsin. This is a national prize-winning program, two awards, as a matter of fact. And we're delighted that you are with us today. You will meet with Chief Justice Day at noon, along with students from Seymour High School and West Salem High School. Now that we've been introduced to you, I'd like to introduce the court to all of you. Ordinarily seated at the far left is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser's seat is empty, and it will be all morning, because Justice Prosser is not participating in either one of the sexual predator cases that we're going to hear this morning. And I will try and remember to announce that before the second case, too. Counsel, I see, is here, and if I forget, please remind me. Seated next to the empty chair is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Seated to my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz, and to his right, Justice John Wilcox, and to the far right, Justice Patrick Crooks. With those introductions made and these matters taken care of, I'll now call the first case, 97-1337, State versus Curiel. Jack C. Hogue represents Mr. Curiel.
Thank you.
Counsel.
As you indicated, I'm Jack Hogue. I'm here today on behalf of Frank Curiel. Mr. Curiel, as the court's well aware, has been found to be a Chapter 980 subject by virtue of a trial to the court held in Milwaukee County. Our contention is that the statute related to substantial probability is vague and needs further definition by this court, and that the court should define that statute as has previously been the law in Wisconsin in Chapter 51 cases as extreme likelihood. And we believe that that definition is necessary in order to protect the rights of individuals from being committed pursuant to standards which the legislature did not intend.
Where did you get that standard? Where does that come from? Extremely? Is that out of the definition of dangerousness? Is that out of the Chapter 51?
In Chapter 51, the original legislation was found to be unconstitutional in the Lesser case back in 1972. The drafting record with respect to that, the subsequent legislation, reveals that the legislature believed that the requirement of Lesser was that there be an extreme likelihood, and that that be essentially synonymous with substantial probability. And then that, in fact, we believe the legislature, by utilizing the same words in the 980 statute, also a civil commitment statute, intended for that to be, in fact, be the case.
But in actuality, that is not the standard, is it, today? That case has gone, as we are aware of, up and down. And I just wanted to know, you're picking it out of what the legislative background was,
correct,
not actually what the case law is.
I believe the case law today still stands for the proposition that substantial probability is, in fact, required in order for a commitment under Chapter 51.
Yes, but the question is on extreme likelihood. That's the standard that you were suggesting.
Well, the reason that we believe extreme likelihood further defines substantial probability is that, in fact, is what the legislature said it equated with back when they passed the 51 law, and there's not been a subsequent change in that language since then. That would suggest that there was a substantial change of thought by the legislature.
That's your position on the legislative history? That's your position about the legislative
That's
history.
Correct.
You're looking to legislative history, you're looking to Lessard.
I'm looking to Lessard and the amendment to the statute, the slight amendment thereafter, yes.
Now, the 5120 does not use that language, though.
Extreme likelihood, that is correct. They use the term substantial probability, but we believe that the legislative history and the drafter's notes were suggest that they were drafting the statute in direct response to the Lessard decision, which in fact did use those words.
And the state says, well, if the legislature intended to use extreme likelihood, they would have done that. That's the response, right?
Correct. That's the state's response to that. And I guess my position is, with respect to that, that all we know is that that certainly was in the mind of the drafters at the time that they drafted it. As they indicated, they drafted it in specific response to Lessard.
So when, in just to follow up on the 5120, that having been a trial judge for a number of years, say for 13 years, and handling these, that was the standard you feel that the state of Wisconsin was using, the extreme likelihood, although it was substantial probability. I certainly see the, you know, you can see the legislative history and background, but I think that the case law does not bear that out. And if I'm wrong, tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, I guess I would disagree with you. I too have practiced in that area for many years, especially when you're younger, you have a tendency to do those types of cases. My wife is the mental health coordinator for the court system in Rock County and deals with them on a weekly basis. And at least in Rock County, the practice has always been that substantial meant to such an extreme that, in fact, we had grave concern that they would harm themselves the next day, that there was imminent harm out there.
So that's the dangerous.
That's the dangerous. Yeah. And I quite frankly, until I began doing this case, I never even contemplated there would be a different definition of substantial probability other than that kind of extreme situation.
Mr. Holm, why do you think we should look to Chapter 51 at all? It seems to me that we've already said in the Post decision, for instance, that the reference to recent overt acts was not something that was required by Chapter 980. So we've already made distinctions between Chapter 51 and Chapter 980. Why should we feel now to be bound by the same interpretation of substantial probability?
Because I think it's the legislature's intention in passing the statute that we have to look at. I'm not trying to contend that there aren't distinctions between the 980 law and the 51 law. There are some, in fact, procedural differences, but I think the legislature's use of the term substantial probability in 980 is the same term that they utilized when they passed Chapter 51. And so I think that, at least at this point, we must consider that that was their intent, and that was their intent that the same standard of dangerousness exists.
Well, isn't there a strong argument that really what we should look at is the decision by the United States Supreme Court in Kansas versus Hendricks, where the court talked about the Kansas statute, upheld the Kansas statute, and the term there is likely. Why shouldn't we just follow that?
Because the question in Hendricks was not, in fact, this question of dangerousness and substantial probability as it related to that. And I think that in the theory behind the Hendricks decision and your decision in the Carpenter Post case was that we were dealing with an extremely small class of the most highly dangerous individuals. And I think that that's how this particular statute was sold as being constitutional. And I think that the intention of our legislature was, in fact, to limit it to that class. So I don't think that Kansas versus Hendricks, in fact, dealt with the issue of substantial probability of harm or what, in fact, was the requisite constitutional degree of harm. And even moving beyond that, we're not even at this point, I mean, we believe there's a constitutional argument that exists, but what we're saying is the statute requires that because the drafters of the statute, knowing what the mental health standard was, made the standard the same. We've already seemed to have dealt with a lot of questions concerning the legislative history, so in terms of the vagueness of the statute, I think that I would have to say it appears to everybody that the statute is vague, and I would concur with that wholeheartedly. I think it's vague for a number of reasons, and I don't think I have to recite for the court the law as it relates to vagueness. Obviously, you all know it better than I do. But any time we have a statute which can be applied in such a way that the finders of fact are applying their own version or their own application, I think we have a vague statute.
Let me take issue with that. Bread and butter are auto accident cases, and the standard is a reasonable person, ordinary care, reasonable. That standard, which is the backbone of our tort system, arguably, you could take the case with that same standard and give it to 12 people on a Monday, and they would come up with a decision different than the same case with the same standard, but to a different group on Wednesday. Does that mean that such a process is constitutionally infirm because triers of fact may interpret reasonable different, or triers of fact may interpret substantial probability different?
It does not with respect to the reasonable. I think that the substantial probability, though, is a different animal than a negligence case. And I think so because I believe that that 980 is really a expert-driven litigation.
But there are a lot of personal injury cases that are nothing. Products liability is nothing but an expert-driven litigation.
But in terms of those cases, most of the time, products liability, somebody will talk about a defect in the particular operation of a machine or something that persons of the common ordinary experience might have some familiarity with, or at least an ability to understand.
Okay, medical malpractice, expert-driven liability.
Same type of situation.
My point is, we've got different kinds of causes of action here, but your argument that a term like substantially probable is too vague, I don't see any difference between using a term like substantially probable and letting triers of fact discern and apply, and reasonable, which we do every day.
See, I guess I disagree because of the framework which we're looking at. Number one, we're dealing with a group of cases in which the subjects are not really very particularly sympathetic figures. They're persons who have been convicted of crimes already. I think, two, we're looking at the type of case where the ultimate harm could be considered to be rather substantial. Any person sitting there looks at it and says, oh my goodness, what if? So we have to be careful about allowing a varying standard of dangerousness depending upon the fact scenario.
That's just common sense. When we use the standard, I'll just throw it out. In a criminal case, or in this case, we may want to use the civil standard, but the point is, beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, beyond a reasonable doubt is, if you subject it to a mathematical formula, beyond a reasonable doubt is something that not I know it when I see it, but there has to be sufficient and substantial evidence to produce that beyond a reasonable doubt. But that is, I'm sure that when an expert would testify beyond a reasonable doubt, there would be different components that go into it. And that's, I think, what Justice Bradley is saying, is that when you use a term such as substantially probable, to try to reduce it to a mathematical formula of likely, more likely, extremely likely. This is why I believe when you read the opinion of the First District is that they said it means what it says it means, at least in the sense that different people can apply it differently, but there has to be a sufficient amount of evidence to bring to that level. So same way with, as I say, beyond a reasonable doubt. If you would use that same standard and say, well, what did the legislature mean when they said beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think there's a distinction that needs to be made there, however, that beyond a reasonable doubt is a burden of proof, and that's the certainty with which we're going to require our fact finder come with a decision. Substantial probability in this case is an element of what is being required to be proven.
And in fact, it's required to be what?
Be proven in the litigation in order to find the person to be a 980. I think
it's like intent.
It's like intent in a criminal case. It's also, it's like substantial probability in a mental health commitment case. We define those terms all the time for people. And in a case like this, where, again, we're dealing with mental health issues, we know that there's a certain amount of uncertainty with the profession as it is in terms of forecasting, making future predictions. I'm concerned that the average person cannot come to a conclusion based of substantial probability based on their framework and their fund of knowledge.
I return to the same problem. You make a distinction that it's an element. Ordinary care is an element. And yet, just because we use the term ordinary doesn't mean that it's constitutionally infirm, vague, and a violation of due process. I mean, what's the difference between a term like ordinary and a term like substantially probable with regard to the issue of vagueness?
Because we're dealing with a past event that we know what happened and whether it meets a certain standard of care, and a future event where we're attempting to predict that something will occur. And the question is, with what accuracy are we going to predict that? And if we do predict it, what is the probability? And what probability are we willing to live with? And what probability are we not willing to live with? And I think the distinction between a past event being compared to a standard and the likelihood that a future event will occur at some point in the future makes the distinction, makes the importance of adding further definition. And also, I think it shows that it's vague because we don't have a feeling. We can't narrow this group of people sufficiently by the term substantial probability. All of the different court of appeals have obviously labored with that very fact. The parties in my litigation labored with it, the court labored with it, and all of the experts. They gave opinions much more likely than not, more likely than not. And I think in the Keenan's case, they did the same, and then the Court of Appeals said, no, it's considerably more likely.
I remain having difficulty, and this will be my final question on the area, because I'm not sure it can be resolved. You now make a distinction in terms of future and past. Again, bread and butter. Doctor, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical probability as to what the future loss of earning capacity will be, as to what the future pain and suffering will be? We do that all the time, and yet we don't consider that too vague to be appropriate.
But I don't think we also phrase the question in terms of, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty that there's a substantial probability that Mr. X will commit future acts of sexual violence? I just think that we're varying so far from what we have as a standard that we can...
Do they phrase the question that way?
I think that's the way the question has to be phrased.
Did they in this case?
In my recollection is that they did. All of the opinions were given to a certain degree of psychological or psychiatric certainty, and then the question, of course, is one of substantial probability. I understand, I'm not trying to ask this court to give you a mathematical formula of it's got to be 80%, it's got to be 75%. But I think that by defining it as extreme likelihood, we dramatically narrow the group of people in terms of dangerousness that we're dealing with.
Do we narrow it if we define it as more likely than not?
I don't think we do. I think more likely than not to me is the same as probability.
Really?
And I understand the definition that the Attorney General says.
Odds are odds for gambling events are stated in terms of probability. The Kentucky Derby horse winner went off at 30-1, which is another way of saying there's 1 in 30 chance that this horse will probably win.
Yes, that's true.
So it seems to. But then at some point, probability fades into possibility, doesn't it? Because possibility is still not an impossibility.
That's correct.
So you think that probability stops at about 50-50?
I think as it relates to this type of civil commitment issue, I think Addington versus Texas tells us that, in saying that society and the individual... Society should not be asked to bear an equal risk. The individual should not be asked to bear an equal risk with society.
Well, on a spectrum of, on one end is an impossibility, and on the other end is an absolute sure thing.
Okay.
Where does possibility fade into probability?
You know, if you were to ask me that before this litigation, I would tell you at 50%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way I've always felt, and that's probably why I'm not a gambler. And at 50%, it then goes on forward and somewhere, you know, ask me to give you a number, I can't. But I think that extreme narrowly defines that class. Because again, when the Attorney General came to you and said this statute's unconstitutional, their language in Post was. We're dealing with a small class here, and I think your decision indicated that. Indicated that we were dealing with a small class of individuals, and that's why this statute was in fact a treatment statute. And the Supreme Court in Hendricks said the same thing. We're talking about a small class.
Well, when we look at, say, a dice with six sides,
okay.
we speak in terms of probabilities. We don't speak in terms of possibilities. The probability is one out of six that a one will be rolled. We don't say the possibility is one out of six.
But do we do that? Are those terms that are interchangeable, and is that really the way we look at it in terms of the law? I mean, I think that's just a matter of perspective.
It's a matter of perspective.
For me, it's a possibility. One out of six.
Well, maybe it's just a phrase that's always been used, so we got accustomed to it, so it sounds funny to our ears to talk about something.
That's possible, too. I guess I've just come from having been involved with civil commitment litigation, and I would never consider in a 50% situation that a person would be held. And that's why I don't think that more likely than not even conveys probability.
So does it help us to look at the various standards of proof that we use? We go from greater weight of credible evidence to beyond a reasonable doubt, and the middle one escapes me. Clear and convincing evidence. Would you agree that substantial probability is less than reasonable doubt?
Yes.
But is it more than, well, how does it match up with the middle standard?
I think it's greater than the middle standard.
What is the middle standard?
But I guess I can't quantify it. You know?
When you say quantify, you've used the term as the court has in two different ways. Quantify can mean a number, 50%. And in the next case, the numbers seem to be important, at least the psychologist so testified. That's mathematical quantification. That term has also been used from the bench and by you to mean a definition. And I don't know if you're familiar with the next case. The defense counsel there gave us a chart. So you had certainty and impossibility, substantially probable, likely, which they see the same. More likely than not, they see as moving towards certainty. Much more likely than not, which appears to be the considerably more likely that the Court of Appeals in the next case, though, moves more towards certainty, and extremely likely moves more towards certainty.
I agree with that.
You agree with that. And you're moving into extremely likely, like the defendant in the next case is asking.
I think it's safe to say we believe the same position. We advocate the same position. Extreme likelihood will sufficiently narrow that class.
But
that's not really mathematical quantification. It's a language. Now, the other thing is, I've been hearing from the bench and hearing from counsel that reasonable doubt's not defined. But we do define reasonable doubt. Jury Instruction 140 talks about what reasonable doubt is.
I don't know that I said that we don't define it. I think we clearly do define it, and I use it quite often.
2502 also does it.
And I've had to cite it quite often in terms of argument. I guess I can't even recall what the question was at that point in time. But yes, we do define it, which I think lends further credence to the need to define substantial probability.
We don't.
They are different, though.
We don't define it in a mathematical sense.
No, you don't.
Yeah, like you're talking about, the defense expert here indicated that it was 48%, and therefore, because he said 48%, that's less than 50. Therefore, as you made the argument that the individual should win out over any societal rights. I mean, that's
my belief.
Made, yes, but that's a mathematical situation that you presented.
But that, I guess, in McKinnon's case, that particular evaluation was done according to some sort of study type basis, and in fact, I would concur that 48% simply cannot be substantially probable. I don't think the definition ever intended that. The legislative definition ever intended that. I don't think it should be that.
Mr. Hall, do you think we get much help from the dictionary in regard to this problem?
Probably not, because there are so many different definitions. I think you'll probably get more help from your common experience of the definition of the word substantial and the word probability. And as I've indicated already, from my own practice has always been that substantially probable meant something well beyond a 50-50 situation. If I was told it was substantially probable that X Horse would win the Kentucky Derby, there's a much greater likelihood of me betting than I would bet in a 50-50 situation.
Well, in doing a little picking and choosing from the dictionary definitions of substantial and of probability, what do you think of a test that's tied to the idea of likely and grounded on a firm basis of fact?
Again, that, I think that the likely there that the Kansas statute is talking about doesn't necessarily deal with the harm. And I'm not sure, I don't believe that that definition really is sufficiently adequate. Also, I don't think it comports with our legislative directive as it relates to that.
Well, don't you think extreme, when you start instructing a jury about extreme likelihood, that the jury is really going to focus on extreme and be concerned with extreme?
It's yes, and maybe that's a good thing. It could be that that would happen, and maybe that's a good thing. Because I think the legislature intended us to deal with a rather small section of the population.
What was their estimate of the number of people that would be involved in this statute?
I don't remember the estimate, but I know that the funding, the appropriation bill, dramatically understated the amount of money that's been spent. I think that the blanket's been thrown way too wide. And, you know, I guess I'm just wanting a little, what I would call intellectual honesty. No problem. If you believe somebody's going to reoffend, sentence them to a longer term. But I think I have great problems when we cloak it. This is obviously a personal opinion in the terms of a mental health law. And I think that substantially probable was not intended to be defined as, in the way that it is being defined by some courts.
Well, but we also have a problem about proof. I think that most psychologists, maybe I'm wrong, would say, look, we have very limited ability now to predict future behavior. We have some, but the tools are really quite limited, and we don't know whether they're accurate. And so, I don't know how many PhDs or MDs you're going to get that can testify on the basis of these tools that it's extremely likely.
I see my red light's on here, but I'm going to answer
you.
Maybe that's the case, and then maybe that's the type of person that shouldn't be held either. My experience has been the opposite. My experience has been that the state's psychologists and psychiatrists will probably be willing to proffer that opinion in a large number of the cases. But I think that the fact finder can make an appropriate decision.
So you don't think it matters for the expert testimony? You think it only matters for the fact finder? Okay.
Well, I think it matters that the expert know that, in fact, what we're talking about here is extremely likely. Because there are a number of them that would still perhaps give an opinion that they didn't fall within the category, but then that's, I consider that to be a good thing.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Wellman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. It's magic. Just magic.
May it please the court. Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. The standard for dangerousness in Chapter 980 is not unconstitutionally vague. This court should not define, need not define the term, and it should not define the term to mean extreme likelihood, because that is not what the legislature intended. A statute is unconstitutionally vague only if it has no core meaning, no standards that the fact finder can use to apply the law to the particular case, but rather must make up their own standards. Chapter 980 is a very tightly standardized statute. It has tight limits. First of all, it requires that the person to be committed under Chapter 980, the person has to have been convicted or adjudicated to have committed a specific list of enumerated offenses. That means it's not good enough if the person has been alleged to have, or even in fact has done it, if there has been no adjudication. More specific to dangerousness, the person has to have a mental disorder. That, in turn, is defined in the statute as a condition affecting the emotional or volitional capacity that predisposes a person to engage in sexually violent acts. So already you've narrowed this to persons with specific disorders that have a specific effect, which is to predispose them.
What is the standard of proof for a mental disorder predisposing?
We have to prove all of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that what you're asking? Okay. Did you have a question? No. Okay. Then the statute defines dangerous, that he is dangerous, this individual is dangerous because he suffers from a mental disorder, which we just defined, that makes it substantially probable the person will engage in acts of sexual violence. So we've narrowed it, we've narrowed it first to people who have acted on their desires or deviancies, as proven by conviction or adjudication of a specific list of offenses, including first and second degree child sexual assault, and that they have a mental disorder that predisposes the person. And then
predisposes them to what?
To engage in acts of sexual violence, which again we're saying is the conduct encompassed in this list of offenses. So, for example, if the person has a disorder that only predisposes them to indecently expose themselves, an exhibitionist, that's not one of the covered offenses. So that wouldn't be sufficient to commit the person. And then we have to show, or the fact finder has to find beyond a reasonable doubt, that this disorder that predisposes the person makes it, in addition, substantially probable that this individual will engage in such acts. And that's important because it helps us to be sure that we're finding as best as we can. We'll not be perfect. We aren't perfect in proof beyond a reasonable doubt guilt determinations either. But we narrow it to the people who are substantially probable to engage in the acts. So that, for example, some numbers were being thrown around in the earlier argument. And I just want to make it clear that, for example, if a specific risk assessment instrument or tool like the VRAG, those kinds of things weren't testified to in this case, but they are in other cases. If that says, for example, that sex offenders who have certain characteristics or certain factors that have been identified, that among the persons with those factors, a person with those factors is 48%, there's a 48% chance, rate of recidivism. So that among this group with these factors, there's a 48% probability or rate of recidivism. That doesn't mean that any individual in that group is 48% likely to reoffend, or only 48% likely to reoffend. That individual, an individual within that population, may be virtually certain or certain to reoffend, depending on what we know about this person and his patterns and his behavior, treatment, lack of treatment, whether he has more than one mental disorder, and all kinds of other factors. So it's misleading, I think, to think in terms of even if a particular test or instrument shows a certain probability, that doesn't mean we're saying that person has only that risk. That's why we need to have individual risk assessments, specifically that the fact finder can engage in, that help us to make sense of numbers that are sort of one step removed.
But the VRAG is individualized to that person. The number that comes out is individualized. Aren't you just saying that you got to add to that clinical judgment and other factors?
Well, it's individualized if that person falls within that group. He wouldn't fall within that group if he didn't have the factors that give him a certain score. But that's not saying that he is 48% likely.
No, but the group of which he's likely. The group of which he is a member is 48% likely.
There's a 48% rate of recidivism. Right.
Sure. Within that group.
Right, within that group. Yeah, but that's all it's saying. And it's not saying if the score were 98%, it's not saying that no one, that everyone in that group is going to reoffend, because 98 isn't 100. And it's not saying that no one, that a person who doesn't have any of those factors will never reoffend. It's just not that perfect.
No. But if you said 98, we fell within the 98% group, I think you could say it's substantially probable, couldn't you? Don't you think the evidence...
Oh, I think most people would agree with that, or that it's extremely likely. But the point is that we don't need to have an extremely likely standard, and the legislature didn't intend an extreme likelihood standard.
Where do you think the 48% group falls with it? Do you think that's substantially probable?
I have trouble answering that question because I have never seen a record where someone is actually saying this person is 48% likely.
Oh, he's in a group. Well, let me just give it to you. He's in a group that's 48% likely. That's the next case, if I understood the case, but we'll hear it. If you're in a group that's 48% likely, then do you think that it's substantial? When you ask the psychologist, do you think he's going to answer that it is substantially probable or not?
Some will and some won't. As I understand, one expert felt that the person was, or some experts felt that the person was substantially probable and some felt he weren't. I will say this, that
but
if
that person that the expert there added other factors and pushed up the percent, let's just take 48%. Do you think a jury verdict would be upheld on just that testimony?
On just that testimony, I don't want to avoid your question, but let me answer it this way. I think that a jury verdict that found that this individual was substantially probable, that was based in part on evidence that he was in a group that's 48% likely to reoffend, should be upheld. Now, they're going to have more facts than that.
What if the person's in a 25% group?
I don't think that that kind of a number of the recidivism rate of the group the person is in is going to tell us whether a verdict that individual is substantially probable should be upheld or not. And the reason is because this individual who falls in that range, in that group that has a 25% likelihood of reoffense, may be individually far more likely than that. For one thing, some of the factors, for example, that go into these assessments, a person may get a point in a particular instrument, and they're all different instruments, and they look at all kinds of different subgroups. But for example, whether the person has an additional offense, an offense in addition to the offense of conviction or the offense of current confinement, an additional sexually violent offense may give that person a point in a certain ranging, scoring instrument. But the fact finder certainly is entitled to also consider, and the expert may well also consider, this person didn't have just one additional offense. This person had dozens of offenses spanning a long term of years. The fact finder is, in this case, has a right to take into account the fact that this individual has both inside the family and outside the family sexual assaults. And that's important, not simply because it's going to give him a point on some test or a factor in and of itself, but it tells us, or it can tell us, some things about this individual. The fact finder is entitled to draw the inference that this person who started out exposing himself to people, then he moved to sexually assaulting a person, the daughter of a live-in girlfriend, a person he might think is not likely to report, he's not likely to get caught, then he escalates. Now he sexually assaults a friend of the daughter who is more likely to report. You see, he's willing, we can make a reasonable inference, the fact finder can, he's willing to take more risks. He's willing, his desire, his deviancy is so great that he's willing to take more risks. When he was out on parole before, he'd been in prison. He knew what prison was like. I assume that most people don't want to go back to prison. Nonetheless, he could not obey even the rules of parole. He wouldn't go to sex offender treatment, even though he was in a sex treatment halfway house. He was drinking, which was in violation of his conditions. He absconded for 8 months For 8 months, the system lost track of him. We don't know what he was doing or to whom. I assume one reason people abscond is because they don't want to be monitored. We can take those individual facts into consideration. They may not fit within a specific tool, but they are certainly information the fact finder is entitled to use. Yeah, the number may also be helpful to the jury.
Counsel, I want to focus on, if I may, on this case and the definition a bit with you.
Mm-hmm.
What's your opinion of what the legislature intended the word probable to mean?
My best understanding is that they really wanted whatever standard was ultimately going to be held constitutional. And I say that because...
That's kind of a back-ended approach.
Well, it's kind of self-serving.
In other words, I'll use the word amorphous, and, you know, whatever word that the court says is going to pass constitutional muster, that's what I mean.
Well, I think in this particular very unique circumstances, I think we can draw that inference. And that's because Lessard came down and said it has to be extreme likelihood that the person will commit... an act that's immediately dangerous.
I'm focusing on what did you believe the legislature intended the word, not substantial, the word substantially probable, but probable to mean? Can you answer that?
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. If I just look at that word, I think it means likely.
And what do you think the legislature intended the word substantial to mean?
I think they intended the word substantial to mean not an amount or a value, like, okay, you've got likely here and then you add on, like scoops of ice cream. It's not that meaning of substantial. It means that it's real or has substance.
Now, I know that that's the argument you advance in your briefs, because the argument, as I recall, goes, you know, look, substantial is could be ambiguous. I mean, here's a meaning. Substantial means of substance. Firm is the term you use. And perhaps you're correct that substantial can mean that. And that's why I asked the question, what do you think the legislature intended? Because it is, for me, a bit of a stretch. I have to be convinced to think the legislature meant, in using the term substantially probable, substantially is a modifier of probable, that they meant of substance. It just doesn't make sense to me. That's not the way that it's used in the vernacular. That's not the way that I've seen it used previously. Does it suggest, does that argument that you advance suggest that when they don't use the term substantially, in a myriad of other cases, that they really don't care if it's of substance? So it's not very persuasive. Can you address what the legislature intended the word substantial to mean?
I think there's two reasons that support that. One, as we pointed out, and I don't believe it's in the brief in this case, but it's in that lower court briefs in Kynes. In Jackson versus Indiana, which was the competency case that held that you can't hold a person forever pending trial just because they're incompetent without giving them the kinds of hearings and process that other mentally ill people get, said that if it looks like he won't regain competency, it's not substantially probable that he'll regain competency within a reasonable period of time, then you have to either let him go or do your mental commitment, your regular mental commitment on him. When we incorporated or codified that Jackson standard, the U.S. Supreme Court used the word substantially probable or substantial probability. We use in 97114 our competency statute likely, even though the committee notes to that statute specifically say this was intended to bring us into conformity with Jackson. Similarly, when we look at terms like probable and probability and likely in other areas of the law, high probability and substantial risk are used in certain areas to define reckless or reckless conduct. That's never meant like a mathematical or statistical kind of probability. And finally, if I may, I think that substantially ties back to my first theme, which is that we wanted the term to be constitutional. I think that the Wisconsin legislature believed that Lessard was wrong and was setting too high a standard in extreme likelihood, but they wanted, obviously, to adopt a standard that would be held constitutional by a higher court. They didn't use extreme likelihood. It's clear to me, at least. They didn't use it because they didn't want to use it if they didn't have to. If you look at Humphrey versus Cady, which is the case that Lessard purported to be interpreting, Humphrey versus Cady says that when we can, and it was addressing our old Sex Crimes Act, and it said, when you, what these mental health statutes are is not just a medical judgment, but also a social and legal judgment about whether the potential for harm is great enough to justify this massive curtailment of liberty, which involuntary commitment is a massive curtailment of individual liberty. Is it great enough? And I think they meant that in the, do we have a solid, real basis for it? It's not just fear. And the reason I say that is because it follows Addington, which makes it very clear that when we're talking about an erroneous deprivation of liberty, that we don't want the individual to share equally with society, that's only part of the quote. The rest of the quote is share equally with society when the harm to the individual outweighs any possible harm to the state. And in that context, they had just finished describing that the risk there, and the reason they use clear and convincing instead of preponderance, is we don't want to lock up people who are just a little odd or idiosyncratic or behave in some unusual behavior. We want to not be able to lock those people up because we're afraid of them or feel fear of them. Now, certainly the sex predator law has taken us way beyond that. I don't think anybody would claim that sexually violent conduct is within the range of acceptable behavior. It's not. We've narrowed it to those people. We've narrowed it to a specific kind of harm, only sexually violent acts. And then within that, we're allowed to look and say, is it likely that they will commit this offense? And is that fact finder, is it substantially likely in the sense that you have found a real basis in the evidence for this?
Ms. Nolan, I have to interrupt
you. I'm sorry, that is fine.
I'm getting nervous. The problem that I see with your position is that in a jury of 12, a number of them may say that substantial probability to them means one out of six chances. A couple of them might say one out of four. A couple of them might say one out of two. What kind of standard is that? A defendant then doesn't really know what standard they're being held to. And the other problem I find with it is that you seem to ascribe to the legislature something that I don't think really exists when they pass legislation. There's no way they can get 133 people to agree what the word substantial probability means. So they truly do leave words like that to the definition, to the definitional abilities of a court. And maybe only four out of seven of us will agree what it means. But nevertheless, I don't think the legislature would say it means anywhere between zero and 100. Now, but that's what your position seems to be, that it, so long as one person says it's 1 out of 100 and another person says it's 99 out of 100, that jury verdict is okay. How do you respond to that?
I'm saying...
I'll tell you where I'm going. I'm thinking that somehow we've got to narrow it down. And I'm inclined to a more likely than not, better than 50-50, something of that nature, so that people of common, ordinary sense have some kind of standard upon which they can agree.
Well, and the problem I see with doing that is that, one, it's not the words the legislature used, but if you feel that you have to give some further definition to those words, although we never have in Chapter 51, and the jury instructions in 51, for all the years it existed, do not define it for the jury, and that has not been seen to be a problem.
Right, but see, I do agree with your response to Justice Bradley that they essentially wanted to put in a word there that would pass constitutional muster.
Right. And
but what you seem to be saying is that one out of 100 passes constitutional muster, and 99 out of 100 passes constitutional muster also.
Well, when you say one out of 100, though, I mean, again, and I don't want to, you know, seem to be picking on the same thing, but I think it's very important that we understand what does that number really mean. I suspect that you're not going to find a record where an expert or a fact finder is really saying, this individual, I have found there's one out of 100 chance. I mean, again, when you're using those probabilities, you still have to say this individual. Now, what might be a legitimate sufficiency of the evidence issue is if you have evidence which shows that there's only the most extremely remote possibility, a tiny, tiny possibility, then an appellate court might say that's not sufficient as a matter of law. But saying more likely than not, in the first place, I don't think that gets you much closer in terms of one jury might conceptualize it as 75% or 55 or 63.5%.
But we should cut out the bottom 50%.
Well, but not in the sense, and this is the real problem with that approach, is if you're saying that means that nobody, that if we have an expert who testifies that this person is within a group of people who have a 48% likelihood of reoffense, or rate of reoffense, that he's below the 50%, he can't be a sex predator. That's wrong because that's just in the numbers.
I would not limit a jury to experts, and I don't think anybody is suggesting that we willy-nilly adopt whatever a scientist up on the witness stand has to say in terms of adopting VRAG or whatever that. They can take into account other things to get them above that level. There's nothing, nobody is suggesting, are they, that we adopt as a matter of law what a scientist says, what 48%?
Well, actually, I think the kindness argument is coming close to that, but I'll leave that
to you. Let me just ask you this. You say that we should not define substantially probable, but the state's position in the next case, and as I hear you, is you do define substantially probable to mean likely.
We are saying that you don't need to define it. We could do as the Curiel Court of Appeals did, just said it means what it means. However, since there now have been arguments certainly made and kindness court suggesting that probable means more likely than not by definition, I think it would behoove you to say that's not correct if you believe that's not correct.
That's right. So your position really is, if I understand it, in the next case too, and I'm trying to see if you're taking two different positions in the two different cases, is that substantially probable, you could substitute the word likely.
Yes. We're both taking that position.
Okay.
Right.
My second question is, when you talk about the groups and you say that the group has 48%, and I don't know how they calculate it, VRAG, but what I hear you saying is that that is a kind of average or mean or median, that some people in that group might have been 60 and some 20, and then there's a kind of average. It doesn't mean everybody in that group is 48.
Right. I don't think it's probably mathematically correct to call it an average, but it does mean that everybody in that group is not the same. Some will be way, way more than that, and some...
And it's somehow a composite calculation is made. That is your position.
A prediction, yeah.
Because
okay. The third question I have is, do you think probable and probability mean the same thing?
Yes, I think they do. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One, we seem to have used them interchangeably throughout the law in various cases that we discussed. And the statute itself says, in the definitional section, it says the disorder makes it substantially probable. And then a few lines later, when it says what you have to put in the petition, it says that it creates a substantial probability. It doesn't make sense to me they meant something different.
All right. And my last point is, at least from all the reading I have done in this area and in other areas relating to probability, that includes such as DNA testing and expert witnesses on that. It's generally agreed, I think, that people don't know how to use statistics. They don't know how to understand and use these numbers when they're given. Do you agree with that?
I think many people do not, and there is a risk of confusion, which obviously the trial lawyers have to straighten out. That's my one other caveat about using more likely than not, because I think to most people that immediately equates with more than 50%, and then that can be misused, for example, to say, well, they didn't say this person was 50% likely. And so if we're going to go with that route, I think that we do need to make it clear, as we did in Hart, as we did in the cases that use the term high probability, that we're not talking a math or statistical probability there. Yes, Justice Wilcox, did you have a question?
It's partly been answered, but opposing counsel, of course, took the position, and that's why we use 48%, because sure. Their defense expert testified that I guess the state's argument, as I understand, is basically whatever we use, if we were to use substantially probable or most likely or whatever standard, it should not be one based on a mathematical formula. Is that it?
Right. I don't think...
So it could be, as going back to both the Chief's question and Justice Bablich, that you would want to use a commonly understood language phrase, but not dealing with a mathematical formula, because people in the 30% range with a background as you describe could be dangerous in the sense of to the public. And what counsel was saying is that, look, when it comes to 50-50, then we favor, or should as a society, favor the individual above the societal interest. And that's something I think you're trying to dissuade us from adopting.
Right, yeah. Right. I don't think that the substantive due process clause requires us, even if we're in a situation where it's 50-50, because, and I don't think we are as in cases, but even if we were, I don't think that that's what Addington means about sharing the risk of error. In the first place, just again, Addington was talking about the harm to the individual of being locked up simply because he's idiosyncratic or a little odd. That's not what we're talking about here. Plus, here, we have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, that's another safety valve. Yeah, the fact that the fact finder has to conclude is, I conclude that he is substantially probable or likely or very likely or whatever word would be chosen to engage in accident. And I believe that beyond a reasonable doubt. That's an additional layer of making sure that the risk of error is not unequal. If we choose a standard of extreme...
Well, let me just interrupt you for a minute. As I've listened to my colleagues, as you've been presenting your argument, I keep hearing the concern that if we just adopt likely as the meaning of substantial probability, that we've ignored the substantial part of that term. And let me ask you whether or not you agree that an appropriate definition for substantial probability would be likely and grounded on a firm basis of fact. That's paying some attention to the substantial part of the term.
I think that would be very appropriate, yes.
You would not disagree with that definition
no.
at all?
But wouldn't that definition apply then to any element probable, is the term we're using now? Reasonable. Why wouldn't it be substantially reasonable? Reasonable and grounded in a firm basis of fact. Reckless disregard. Reckless disregard and grounded in a firm basis in fact. I mean, isn't that just automatic? That if you've got a standard that's beyond a reasonable doubt, it better well be grounded in a firm basis of fact.
I think of using the term that Justice Cripps was suggesting, I think what we're trying to convey to the jury is that you have to have a basis in fact. Separate from the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, you have to find reasons to believe this individual is likely, apart from any class he might fall within, and you're not finding him to be a sex predator just because of generalized fear.
I mean, as I follow it then, likely and based in firm fact beyond a reasonable doubt, huh? If what is based, isn't beyond a reasonable doubt mean based in firm fact?
No. I mean, you could certainly have something that was based in firm fact that,
but not
beyond a reasonable doubt. And I mean based in firm fact in terms of real or some real substance to it. And I realize that you may not draw that line where I choose.
One quick swing to standard of review, and I really liked your answer earlier that when we're dealing with substantially probable, you said, well, they wanted to adopt a standard that would pass constitutional muster. Justice Bablich picked up on that, too. And I think that's true. They wanted to adopt a standard that would that would pass constitutional muster, and they also wanted to adopt a procedure. The legislature wanted to adopt a procedure that would pass constitutional muster. Therefore, you have a civil action, when we say this is a civil action, but with all the procedural safeguards of criminal law. The criminal law constitutional rights, the criminal law procedure, because we're dealing with a massive curtailment of liberty. Why not, then, shouldn't the standard of review also be the most that would provide the most safeguard to the respondent, and that is a civil standard of review, because that provides the benefit to the respondent, much like the criminal procedures and the criminal rights. Can you respond to that?
Well, I think for two reasons. One, the legislature gave the person, it requires the state to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, and I think it will be somewhat difficult for appellate courts to use that standard, you know, be reviewing whether evidence meets that standard they're so familiar with, and yet that would be divorced from a whole body of law that talks about the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. I also think, I don't know that the civil is that different when we're looking at, certainly at fact-finding and credibility determinations and the kind of argument.
No, but the de novo makes it different.
De novo does, and that is not the civil standard. The problem with the civil standard we have is the problem as it is used in K&K, which we think is wrong, whether it's civil or criminal. And I see my time is way up.
I just have one simple question.
Sure.
Does likely and grounded on a firm basis in fact, is that the equivalent of more likely than not?
It doesn't have to be, no. Not in terms of it has to be over 50%.
Well, you think more likely than not means more than 50%.
I think many people equate it.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ho.
I still haven't heard anything that would suggest that the legislature back when they passed the 51 law meant anything other than extreme likelihood. The Attorney General's opinion issued in 1982 was that the term extreme likelihood and substantial probability as it related to the 51 statute were synonymous. Essentially, they meant the same thing. That 1982 opinion was done after all of the litigation in Lessard and the two subsequent decisions in Lessard had been completed. The reference in the state's brief was, well, the final word on Lessard had not been heard, and in fact it had been heard, and the Attorney General knew that in 1982 when he issued such an opinion. So I think it's without question that with respect to 51, substantial probability and extreme likelihood equate, are equal. Then as we move on and we ask ourselves, well, the legislature used the exact same terms in terms of the passage of the 980, I still haven't heard anything that would convince me that that's not significant, and in fact, it is significant. And I think what's intended is extreme likelihood and substantial probability are synonymous. I think that the